Now today, People to People, and your host, Ron Newman.
Well, good morning. It is almost 19 minutes, actually, after 9 o'clock. Got a lot of commercials to get in. We got two breaks coming up. One at the half hour and one at 45 minutes past the hour. I want to get right to my guest, because this is one of the most fascinating people we've talked to in a long time. His name is Dave Champion, and the last time Dave was with us on the air, actually, we had him on twice, because he was on twice during Truth and Taxation Week, which aired a month ago this week, as a matter of fact, and he's back again today. Dave, how you doing?
I'm well. Good morning, Ron. Thank you for having me again.
How's things out in sunny California?
Absolutely spectacular.
Well, you know, we hate you people out there about this time of year. Cause,
what's the weather like in Chicago today?
Well, right now, it's only about 27 degrees out there, but we're looking for a high of 50, and it looks like we might even hit 65 tomorrow. What is it where you are?
I'll try and be kind. It's beautiful sunny skies, and I think it's supposed to hit 75 today.
Yeah. Well, goodbye, Dave. It's nice talking to you. how's your good behavior?
Excellent.
Good. I was very anxious to talk to you today because, if you don't mind, I want to give the lineup for next week, and then we'll explain why you're with us this morning.
All right.
Next week, as we've told you several times already this morning, next week we are going to do a five-part series. Actually, it's kind of like 10 because we got 2 hours per day. And it's going to be on the Federal Reserve System and, you know, the Fed, as they call it, the Federal Reserve. You know, Alan Greenspan, who's the chairman of the Federal Reserve. And that whole conglomerate, we are going to be featuring that next week. The history behind it, a fascinating history, by the way, and what it was designed to be, what they said it was going to be, what it turned out to be, what it is not, all that's going to be covered. It's going to kick off Monday with Ed Griffin. G. Edward Griffin is his full name. And he has written a book back in 1994 called The Creature from Jekyll Island. He will be our guest for 2 hours on Monday. And then on Tuesday, another man who's been on this radio station before, although it's been some time, Sherman Skolnick. You remember him. He's going to talk about the connection between bribery and the Federal Reserve and the Bush administration. And then on Wednesday, March 19th, Ed Henry will join us. And Fred Smart is in the studio with us. Dave, say hello to Fred.
Good morning, Fred.
Hi, Dave.
And what is it that Ed Henry is going to be addressing?
Well, Ed has specialized. He's got a site, and he specializes in forensic accounting issues as it relates to the government budget. And he's going to be walking us through some of the examples from an accounting perspective of the budget process as it relates to the Fed. In that 1 hour period.
All right, and then the second hour on Wednesday, Bernard von Nothaus will be on again with us. He too is a past guest on this radio station. He heads up NORFED, and we'll more about that, of course, next week. Then on Thursday, March 20th, Bill Benson is going to be on the air with us. We're delighted to have a chance to have him on the air. And if I'm not mistaken, I think we had him on once before about a year and a half ago. Tell the people who Bill Benson is, Fred.
Well, Bill is the author of a two-volume set called The Law That Never Was, that focuses on the 16th Amendment, which is the genesis, the foundation that gave the Federal Reserve the green light without that law. He will be walking through some of the background history as it relates to that that day.
Then, at the second hour on Thursday, March 20th, Joe Bannister will once again be with us. Joe Bannister, a former IRS agent. And what is he going to be talking about this time, Fred?
Well, Bill Benson was, in effect, Joe's teacher for a lot of what Joe wrote in his research to the IRS before he left the IRS. A good 40-50% of what he wrote had to do with the Federal Reserve. And a lot of what he got came from Bill Benson, and the two are going to sort of function as a tag team that day.
And then, to round out the week, on Friday, March 21st, Walker Todd will be with us for a full 2 hours from 8 a.m. to 10 a.m. Well, actually, 8:15 a.m. to 10 a.m. Central Time. I understand Walker Todd is a rather fascinating individual himself. What is he going to be addressing?
Well, Walker was a former lawyer with the Federal Reserve and has years and years of experience. He was the author of the redress of grievances with the We the People Congress. And he will walk you through quite an engaging two-hour period of history on the Fed as it relates to the legal issues.
And I misspoke earlier because I was under the impression that today's guest, Dave Champion, would be returning on Monday, March 24th. But indeed, I'm wrong, as I have been many times before. On Monday, March 24th, for 1 hour from 8 to 9, Aurora time here, Central time, Bob Schultz will rejoin us once again to wrap up with a discussion about the Federal Reserve redress of grievance that, of course, Fred Smart just told you about. And so that's what we're in store for next week. Now, Dave Champion, you are going to tell us some of the basic constitutional underpinnings of the discussion, which will take place next week. Where would you like to begin, Dave?
Well, I think we should begin, with the realization that the Federal Reserve as an institution is not the inherent evil. Now, of course, a lot of people beat the Federal Reserve drum that the Federal Reserve is evil and the Federal Reserve is bad and the Federal Reserve is unconstitutional. First of all, I should say the Federal Reserve is not unconstitutional, but we'll come back to that in a little bit. So people might say, why does the Federal Reserve exist? How did it come into being? Why did it come into being? What is its purpose, both actual versus perceived or advertised back at the time of its creation? The Federal Reserve System, put simply, is the management agency that is necessary when a government or a nation implements a fiat currency system. Now,
I was just going to ask you, what is this thing called a fiat currency system? What does that mean, Dave?
A fiat currency system, I can't give you an economist's definition, but I'll give you, I think, what is a working man's definition. A fiat currency system is where you have paper or something similar to paper, which is not tied to anything of substance in the background.
Like, for example, gold?
Like, for instance, gold. Like,
silver.
Like, for instance, any sort of commodity that has a fixed value in the sense that it is meaningful and substantive to people.
Okay.
Today, of course, we know that we have these little pieces of paper that are somewhat green in color called Federal Reserve notes, and they are backed by absolutely nothing. Now, of course, if you talk to the government, they'll tell you they're backed by the good faith and credit of the United States government. But I think since we're running several hundred trillion dollars in debt in every decade or so, we have to restructure the debt because we can't make the interest. I would question what good faith and credit of the United States government really exists. I know that if you and I ran our business or our household finances the way the government has been doing so since World War II, we would not be considered responsible husbands or parents or members of the community.
We'd either be broke or in jail or both.
Exactly. Well, so much of what the government does, if we did it, we'd be in jail. But going back to the issue, the Federal Reserve is nothing more than the necessary management organization when you operate a fiat currency system. If we got rid of the fiat currency system tomorrow, we would not need to get rid of the Federal Reserve. It would dry up and blow away on its own.
If you said if we got rid of the fiat currency tomorrow, you wouldn't have to get rid of the Federal Reserve. You said it would just dry up and blow away all on its own.
Exactly.
How?
If we are functioning on the lawful money of the United States, which, by the way, is silver, a lot of people think it's gold, but the actual lawful money of the United States is silver, that's what was used as the medium of exchange primarily at the time of the Revolutionary War and the time of the adoption of the various state constitutions and the federal constitution. So when we look at lawful money, if we were to be using lawful money, there would be absolutely no role for the Federal Reserve, because the Federal Reserve issues paper money and it manages the various processes, which there are many, that balance, if you will. I don't consider that they really balance, but from the point of view of the Federal Reserve, that balance the fiat currency system and keep it afloat. Now, if we didn't have fiat currency to have to balance and keep it afloat, the Federal Reserve, maybe they wouldn't drive them away, it would become completely irrelevant. Alan Greenspan would be a name not known. The position of chairman of the Federal Reserve Board would be a position not spoken of. There would be no media coverage. Nobody would care if it were not for the fiat currency system. So, having said this, how did the Federal Reserve come into being in the first place? Well, there was a series of cases when the government decided that they wanted to get involved in the fiat currency system, which, by the way, occurred in the midst of the Civil War, was when the first fiat currency system came into being. And that was eventually challenged. And back in, gosh, I don't remember exactly when it was, I think it was around 1870, in a case called Hepburn v. Griswold, the U.S. Supreme Court looked at the fiat currency system and said it was unconstitutional, you can't do that. And that decision was written by one of the greatest Supreme Court justices, Samuel P. Chase. Well, Ulysses S. Grant, who was president at the time, was enraged by this decision because it had severe economic consequences for the North. And so what he did is he immediately, there were a couple of openings on the Supreme Court at that point, he immediately filled them with nominees that were very, very sympathetic to Grant's position, which at that time was the Republican Party. And then with those two justices in place, they brought two new cases back to the court, in a case called Knox v. Lee and a second case called Parker v. Davis. The court did an about-face and said that there was no problem with fiat currency. There was an additional case in 1884 called Juilliard, which is what people study when they want to become an economist. And Juilliard confirmed the earlier decision. However, the part that is missed by most people when they read the cases that confirmed the act that created the fiat currency was that it is not a currency that is lawful money. This remains that way to say, by the way. It is not a form of currency that is lawful money of the United States. Lawful money of the United States is fixed as a phrase in the Constitution. In pursuance of that, if you go into the United States Code, tells you what lawful money is, and it's not paper, it's not fiat currency.
Dave, can I stop you for a minute? Because we are right up on a break. I'd like you to hold that thought, and we'll pick up right from where you left off after this timeout here on AM 1280 WBIG. And I'd like to welcome back my guest, Mr. Dave Champion. Dave, let's pick up from where you left off.
All right. We were talking about the fact that lawful money is not paper currency. Lawful money is defined in the United States Code, and it is gold and silver coin. Now, so we might say, well, hang on, I'm confused. If in the Constitution it was clear about what money is, and if that's even codified into the United States Code as it is, the question then becomes, well, then what's this paper stuff, and under what authority did the government do this? Well, initially, back in the Civil War, the act of Congress that created the issuance of paper money was eventually sustained by the court under the implied powers of the Constitution. Well, what's the implied powers? Well, the implied power was the ability to finance a war. If you're going to give the Congress the power to make war, and the president the right to be the commander-in-chief to prosecute that war, an implied power is emergency methods or extraordinary methods to finance a war, because, of course, war is an ugly business, and it's a complex business, and it's not the normal affairs of life. So it is reasonable to step outside the normal affairs of life, the normal way of doing things, when you're in a crisis. So the court basically said, under the implied powers of conducting a war, you can issue paper money. Now, later in Juilliard, where the court much later sustained the fiat currency system once again, it did it under another justification, which was the territorial authority of the United States. Now, the territorial authority is found in Article 1, Section 8, Clause 17, and then the power to make rules and regulations in Article 4, Section 3, Clause 2. So, under these two provisions of the Constitution, the Supreme Court in Juilliard once again validated paper money, fiat currency. it is still, to this very day, as you and I talk, Ron, it is not the lawful money of the United States, insofar as the 50 states of the Union. It is a lawful means of exchange to be promulgated by the federal government for its needs, whatever that might be, international possessions, territories, settling its debts. That is why the cases that rule on it are not called the money cases, because lawful money is something entirely different. They are referred to collectively, all four cases, as the legal tender cases. And a legal tender is something entirely different from money. So we have, basically, two economic systems. One is a system of money. One is a system by legal tender. Now, originally, money was pervasive. And legal tender was by far a tiny percentage of what was in circulation. What we have found, what we have today, is over all of these decades, we have a situation in which money, lawful money, has become virtually extinct. And this fiat currency system, this legal tender, has spread its tentacles and taken over. Now, the problem with this is several. First of all, when you have a legal tender system that takes over a country, it is not a true monetary system. It is an economic system, I'll grant you that, but it's not a true monetary system, and it cannot be sustained. I believe, historically, the longest any fiat currency system has ever lasted on the face of this earth has been 100 years, and we're creeping up on that pretty fast. Of course, circumstances, adverse circumstances, can collapse a fiat currency system much faster than that 100-year period. So the fact that we haven't reached that mark yet should not give us great security or confidence. And we should be making plans to move back away from the fiat currency system if we want this nation to prevail. Because once a nation's currency, once their economic base erodes, and erodes substantially, they cease to be a significant power on the face of the earth. That is a historical lesson. That is a truism. Additionally, a fiat currency system is one that is constantly devolving. And the analogy I use is this. I think as kids we've all seen those glass tubes with the fluid in it and the ball floating in the fluid. Sort of, I think it was always like a physics thing we were shown in school. Well, the analogy I use is this. In that glass ball, there's a line. And on the glass tube, there's a line. And the job of our society, so to speak, is to keep the line on the glass ball inside the tube floating right where the line on the glass tube is. We're keeping a balance. We're keeping it level. Well, we have a situation where decades and decades ago, one person from the family, typically the father, could go out and work, and he could keep that ball afloat. And the analogy I use is by pedaling a bicycle. He could go to work and he could pedal at a moderate pace and he could keep the ball afloat. Well, what started happening was, with the fiat currency system and the way it is much like cutting the bottom out of your pocket and then putting money into it, he began to have to pedal faster to keep the ball in place. And then again, he noticed the ball dropping, so he'd have to pedal yet again faster. And after a while, the ball would drop further. And pretty soon, he was pedaling at a mad dash to keep the ball afloat. Well, of course, we all know what has eventually happened. Now, the husband or the father is not out there working, keeping the ball afloat. He's out there pedaling as fast as he humanly can. Now, his wife, or the mother, is also out of the workforce, and she's pedaling furiously. And I think we all know what the bottom line is. The ball is still dropping. It was dad working for decades and decades and decades. Then it was dad and mom working part-time. And then it was dad and mom working full-time. And despite more and more effort being put into the equation, the ball is still dropping. It's getting harder and harder to make ends meet. And that is not, for your listeners, that is not circumstance. That is the reality of a fiat currency system. That is how it works. That is how it has always worked. When you read about the history of fiat currencies, there's never been a time when a nation has become economically more healthy under a fiat currency system.
Let me stop you for just a minute, because I would imagine, Dave Champion, that there's probably some listeners out there today that are saying, well, So who cares if it's fiat currency or not? It works. I mean, I get paid with it. I can take it to the store and buy groceries with it. I can buy gasoline with it. I can put it in the bank. I mean, and draw interest off of it. I can pay off private debts. Like, you know, I can loan you $5 and you can pay me back and we're both happy. You know, I mean, what difference does it make whether it's, I mean, if you call it fiat currency, it certainly works like real money.
Well, it does only to an extent, and I don't want to get into the whole issues that it's actually a debt instrument, it's hypothecated debt. I think that's not a place that your audience really wants to go. I will say this. Real money, whether it be silver, whether it be gold coins, what have you, real money has a true intrinsic value. Yes, it fluctuates, absolutely, we know that. But it has a underlying intrinsic value that cannot be damaged. In other words, as circumstances, say, in the economy get worse, the value of gold rises. However, with paper money, with a fiat currency system that is not backed by anything, there is no intrinsic value, none whatsoever. What makes the dollar bill function is it's sort of a common public perception, a belief, a training, if you will, a brainwashing, to put it in a more negative sense, that it has some meaning. But in reality, it has no meaning whatsoever except in the mind of the person receiving it. It's like a mass hypnosis. I give you this worthless piece of paper, but you have been socialized or hypnotized to believe that it represents something. And the only thing it might possibly represent when I give it to you is my hard work. Well, it should represent something more than that. It should have something that has an intrinsic value unto itself. But it does not. It is worth less than a penny in actual, the paper name. And that is all that it is worth. The minute that you hand it to me, Ron, and I say, okay, that's a $100 bill, you're trying to pay me $100, but you're handing me something which to me has the value of a penny in paper and ink, and I'm not going to accept that, give me something that's really worth $100, Ron. Suddenly the reality comes home. Now, as long as our economy is healthy, the hypnosis continues, the socialized view continues, and people exchange these things back and forth as if they have some meaning. What history shows is when the economy starts to go bad and confidence begins to be undermined, it breaks the societal view, it breaks the hypnosis, and all of a sudden the money starts, you've heard the term hyperinflation.
Mm-hmm.
Suddenly nobody believes that the paper's worth anything anymore. And all of a sudden, $100, what was worth $100 yesterday, a $100 bill had this ephemeral value of $100. Next week it has the value of $33 or $12 or $17. It buys the same thing a week later that you have to pay much, much more. That's called hyperinflation.
Dave, I have to take another break. We'll be back with my guest, Dave Champion, and we have a phone call on that's waiting to talk to you, Dave, and we'll bring the caller on the line with us after this final timeout on today's People to People with my guest, Dave Champion. And I want to welcome back my special guest, who it's always a pleasure to talk with, Mr. Dave Champion. I want to continue because I thought of a good analogy to all this, but before we go into that, Dave, I've got a caller that's waiting to talk to you. His name is Bob. He's from Elgin, Illinois, about 22 miles up the Fox River from where we're sitting here. And Bob, good morning. Say hello to Dave Champion.
Good morning, Dave.
Good morning, Bob. How are you?
I'm doing fine. The thing I'd like to bring up and ask your opinion on, in the past 30 years, the United States has gone from a creditor country to the biggest debtor country, to the point where our current balance or account or trade deficit is astronomical, which means that there are people outside of this country who are affecting the value of our currency. And what I see now with the new competing fiat currency of the euro, that the euro is going up and the dollar is going down. George Soros said that this country's current balance, which is at a record deficit, could, eventually cause that run on this currency. In other words, it won't be Americans' confidence that'll be shaken. It'll be the shaking of the people outside this country who hold this currency, who then finally tell the United States, this currency is no longer valuable. And in other words, it would sink it from the outside. What's your opinion on that?
Absolutely correct. First of all, George Soros is a brilliant man, in my opinion. And Bob, the points that you raise are very, very relevant, not just in a general economic sense, but to some of the things that we're seeing going on right now at this time historically. One of the concerns that I have about running such high trade deficits and having so many foreign banks involved in our national debt situation is that that is not a prescription to maintain our independence. And the fact of the matter, no matter how anybody would care to argue otherwise, especially politicians, if we are not, as far as our government functions, if we are not financially independent, we will not long remain free. Because as we all know, even when we go back to being a child, when your parents were in control of the money, you were not free. And one of the things that allowed you to become your own person and to execute freedom in the world for yourself was your ability to go out and earn a living and have your own money and not be beholden to anybody else. That's one of the things that's so horrible about consumer debt, of course. Well, those principles don't evaporate when we suddenly get to the national level. When we permit others to have leverage or control or to be able to make declarations or determination about our currency, about our financial situation, we risk our liberty and our freedom. And Bob, you're absolutely right.
And this is where I've seen the International Monetary Fund, IMF, and World Bank step into smaller countries, whether it's Argentina, Thailand, or whatever, after there's been a run on their currency by George Soros, and tell them that it's all kind of over for you people. Someday I'm thinking we're going to be told by the international community that it's over for you people. And the euro will replace the dollar. But anyway, I'll let you go on that.
Bob, thanks for a very important contribution.
One thing he mentioned between the dollar and the euro.
Mm-hmm.
While he's certainly right, there's a possibility that there might be plans for the ascension of the euro and that the dollar is going to become a secondary form of currency. I would say what's probably more likely than that is that at some point there's going to be a suggestion that's going to take on a great political impetus to merge currencies and to create regional currencies that reach beyond national frontiers, shall we say.
You know, I want to mention it because we're coming up on the top of the hour, and doggone it, this 45 minutes has gone way, way too fast. But I thought of a good analogy, and I can't remember who it was that made it, whether it was Ed Griffin or one of the other authors. It was Ed Griffin. He said, look at it this way. Let's go back 2,000 years. Let's go back to the time of the Romans and the chariots and all that, the Ben-Hur type stuff and all that. And just picture that. A well-dressed man could take, let's say, a gold coin, a one-ounce gold coin, and he could go out and he could buy himself a toga and a nice hand tool leather belt and a pair of sandals for himself, and he would have been a fairly well-dressed gentleman back then. You take that same ounce of gold today, 2,000 years later, what can a man buy with it? He can go to the men's store, and he can buy the suit of today. He can buy a nice jacket. He can buy maybe a vest, a shirt, a leather belt, pants, and a nice pair of wingtip shoes, probably for about the same money, and actually be better dressed now than he would have been 2,000 years ago. Why? Because that gold still has value. Whereas you look at a car, like let's go back to the 1950s, about 1955, 56, when you could go out and buy a Chrysler New Yorker, which of course was a much bigger car then, for right around $3,800, $4,000, somewhere in that area. what kind of a car can you get for $4,000 or $5,000 today but a junker? So I think, you know, a new car comparably equipped with all the improvements is going to cost somebody probably close to eight times as much as it did back in the 1950s. And that's the difference that we're talking about here between gold, which has an intrinsic value, and fiat money, as you said.
Absolutely correct. I think a similar analogy I had heard that if you took the cost of the average single-family home back in the 50s, and you said, okay, let's say that home cost $12,000.
Dave, I hate to do this. I just was notified that somebody called in that I definitely want to have on the air with you, and he argues against a lot of these things. His name is Charles. Charles, you're on with Dave Champion. Good morning.
Thank you, Ryan, for allowing me on at the last minute.
I've been waiting for you to call in, my friend. Go ahead.
I want to thank your caller for confirming that, first of all, in the beginning moments of his speaking, that the Federal Reserve System is not inherently evil. I really appreciate you clarifying that. And my question is this. You mentioned George Soros was mentioned a couple of times, and you complimented him as being a brilliant man.
All right, we're running short on time here.
Okay, here's my question. What George Soros does when he speculates on currencies of various nations throughout the world, I do not believe that what he's doing is evil either. I think he's filling a necessary void in the currency system. Do you agree with that, or is he doing something bad?
Well, I don't know if he's filling a necessary void. He may be taking a prudent business opportunity. I don't perceive that George Soros as an individual or as a businessman is evil. He's not functioning in the government system. He's not making decisions unilaterally that affect the lives of citizens like the government does. I have no particular criticism of George Soros. As I said, I think he's a brilliant man. Now, I don't always appreciate everything a brilliant man does.
With that, gentlemen, I got to cut it short. Yes, sir. Thank you for calling in. Please call in next week, too. That's all the time we're going to have for phone calls this morning. We've only got a minute left before we have to get out of here for top of the hour news, Dave. But I wanted to give you maybe about 40 seconds or so to make any final comments.
Well, I think the most valuable comment that I could make to your listeners would be to listen for the rest of the segments that you're going to be doing over the upcoming week. The guests that are going to be on are going to be fantastic. They're going to know far more about the Federal Reserve System than I do. And they're going to be able to round this picture out in a way that your listeners will truly understand the issue. And it's very, very important that Americans begin to understand this most important issue so that our freedom and our liberty have the greatest opportunity to continue.
Well, with that, I want to once again thank you for taking the time to talk to our listening audience here today. Please keep in touch with us, and we will see to it that you get a copy of this show as well.
Thank you, Ron.
Thanks, Dave.
Bye-bye.
Dave Champion, you're listening to AM 1280 WBIG Aurora, Naperville.